Here's something you won't hear a politician say in 2018. Immigration into Europe is much, much too low. Our guest today has calculated that the continent's going to need at least 200 million new workers in the next 30 years. Welcome to Vox Talks, a series of interviews with the world's leading economists. My name is Tim Phillips. In the developed world, as we get richer, we live longer, and we have fewer children to support us in our old age. Meanwhile, developing countries spend billions on targeted interventions to help the poor, with benefits that are far lower than if citizens could just earn some more money. Lant Pritchett of Harvard University has a big idea that he thinks can solve both problems at once, and you might have heard of it. It's called mass migration. Lant, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you know that the position you're going to argue today, Lant, is a point of view that almost nobody else in the entire developed world holds.
I enjoy being alone.
Well, your reasoning for this starts with the way in which we're doing development today, and interventions that relieve poverty are based on the results of field experiments, and your calculations show that the outcomes are very small compared to the investment we're putting in. Can you give us some examples of that?
Yeah. The difficult fact to admit is that the world isn't full of poor people. The world is full of people in poor places. And if you take a person that's trapped in a poor place that has low productivity and try and intervene and raise their productivity while still in a low productivity place, the gains you should expect to be modest. And on the order of 5 to 10% increase in rate of return to things that try and increase the income of the poor. So the most replicated anti-poverty program in terms of rigorous evidence is called the graduation approach that's been used widely by a Bangladesh NGO and was recently evaluated with a rigorous randomized controlled trial in 7 different countries. And it showed positive rates of return. But let me tell you what positive rates of return mean. They spent $4,500 per household to generate $334 in income in year 3. Now, if one extrapolates that $334 persists for 20 years, one gets a positive rate of return. But you got to admit, $334 a year is pretty tiny. People are trapped in low productivity places, and they're not low productivity people. They're just trapped in low productivity places. So intervening person by person is a very tough way to make progress.
And your argument is also based on the sorts of returns that these people get if the economies that they're in could just grow faster. So can you give us a comparison of that as well?
Yeah. On the other hand, economists have a concept of overall economy-wide productivity, which, you know, we often, in our equations, we call A. It's just what multiplies my efforts to get to the total output. And what we've learned is that most of the variation in why I'm rich and somebody in a poor country is poor, a little bit is my characteristic, but a lot of it is the A of the place they're in. If you can get dynamic about A, you can generate very large gains. So if you look at the gains of the acceleration of growth, for instance, in India, the growth accelerations in India that started in the early 90s have led cumulatively to trillions of dollars of gains. So massive gains across all Indians. So economy-wide interventions that can cause a dynamic of the whole economy to start rising because all factors are getting more productivity and people can make more investments, those can have serious scaled effects. On the other hand, those are very hard to create. We don't really have a rigorous science of creating and sustaining rapid growth in any country, and even in the poor countries. India and China famously have had long and extended growth episodes, and that's terrific, but we don't have a reliable, reproducible science of reproducing countrywide economic growth. So the gains from that are huge, but it's also difficult to create.
One of the arguments that people would say in favor of these interventions is they don't exist because people want to do them. They exist because we've attempted to grow and growth hasn't been good enough. So even though the returns might be small, they're better than nothing.
Yeah, I am not out to attack any given philanthropic or other organization from carrying out effective interventions that help people. I have no objections to any of that. But the slogan, or what I would like to be a slogan, is the best you can do is worse than the least you can do. What do I mean by that? The best you can do in terms of a targeted intervention that works with poor people in rural Ethiopia to increase their income produces orders of magnitude smaller gains to income than if you just allowed that person to come and work in the UK or in Germany or in the US doing low-skilled labor. So the gains from allowing a low-skilled person to move to the U.S., where we've done the rigorous economics and are pretty confident of the number, is on the order of $17,000 a year. So the in-situ, in-place intervention, about $330 a year. 1 year of mobility is $17,000. It's just night and day. And why do I say it's the least you can do? Because you pay them $17,000 because that's actually what they do. They can actually provide $17,000 worth of services because they're in a high productivity place. So allowing people to move from a low productivity place to a high productivity place has just enormously more potential gains and completely surefire gains compared to either individual interventions, which are small, or growth interventions, which are huge, but really uncertain.
But is it a sure thing? Because if you look at what's happening to many of the unskilled migrants who come to the developed world at the moment, they're not all doing well, regardless of whatever the political environment is.
This is the difficult thing, though, is it's very hard for people in rich countries to imagine the counterfactual. So they might look like they're doing terribly relative to what you would think is good and what I would think is good, but they might be still doing spectacularly better than what their opportunity was if they had stayed at home. So in our study, which was using census data from the U.S., the average income of low-skilled people in the U.S. was only about $10 an hour. You or I working for $10 an hour, we wouldn't be thrilled with it, and we'd have a much, much lower lifestyle. That said, the average of what they were coming from was $2.20 an hour. So even if we look and say, oh, these migrants are not doing well, yeah, they're not living like we're living, but you got to think of what the counterfactual is, and it really is just a pretty surefire bet, and particularly under what I would be proposing, which is regulated rotational migration, you would have a process of ascertaining that people had a work opportunity before they came, so the odds they would come and disappear into the unemployed would also be low.
Your argument, which is not one that's regularly made, is that we need this mass migration in a developed world.
Yeah.
You're saying the demographic transition in developed economies means that we're getting older, and economically that's a very bad thing.
Well, I don't call it a demographic transition. I call it demographic suicide. The demographic transition that demographers used to think about was fertility going from high levels and plateauing at 2 or 2.1, which is roughly the replacement level of fertility. What happened was Europe, in particular, just crashed through that floor, and fertility went as low as 1.1, 1.2. At 1.1 and 1.2, populations shrinking in a way populations have never shrunk before in history. When population shrinks because fertility goes down, what they call the demographic pyramid inverts so it's standing on its tip. So I did a calculation that by 2050, there'll be four times as many people in Japan over 80 as under 15. So imagine a society and all of the implications that has, that you have four times as many people over 80 as you have that are young, and which means there's going to be almost as many people, not just of retirement age, but well into old age, relative to the population. But just can't be managed on a couple of levels. One, just the pure who's going to care for the elderly is a huge issue. Elder care and home health care and all of the accoutrements of aging require labor. Second, who's going to pay for it? Because Europe has wonderful, generous social protection programs that protected people through their life cycle, including old age pensions. Those are just completely unsustainable. If you have two retirees per worker, the worker, even if they're paying 100% tax, can't sustain the pension rates and pension ages, anything like what Europe has. And tinkering at the margins just don't help relative to the magnitude of the demographic transition. So the calculation you started with, how many new workers would we need to find in order to keep the ratio of the labor force aged population to retiree population constant at its current levels, you'd need but something on the order of 250 million more people. That's millions and millions more a year than any European country is actually taking in. Jack Goldstone, who's at George Mason, puts it, Europe doesn't have an immigration problem. It has an integration problem. And if it can't figure out how to integrate the workers they need into their society and economy, they're in very dire straits in terms of the consequences of the demographic suicide that they're engaged in.
But yet, if you look if you look at the social problems that recent immigration has caused, and this immigration is, what, less than a fifth of what you say that European economies need today.
Yeah.
So what can we do about that integration problem to make this whole thing less painful?
Now, I think that to solve this integration problem, the workers are going to have to be integrated into the economy without necessarily being integrated into the polity. So let me tell you why I'm alone in my views. In Europe, for 100 years, two questions have been conflated. One question is, who is a citizen of our polity that helps determine how our sovereignty is ruled, and who can legitimately work inside our country? Those questions have been forced to be the same. And that was the fundamental revolution of early 20th century migration policy, as it closed the borders and linked those two. One doesn't often look to the Gulf states for examples, but in Kuwait, they have no problem making that separation. They say, these people are eligible to live and work in our country under the following conditions, paying the following taxes, eligible for the following benefits, but they are not on a path to citizenship. Now, I think for a lot of perfectly legitimate moral reasons, that makes people uncomfortable. But I think there is a way to create development-friendly, rights-respecting, rotational mobility. Meaning, I think it grates on people's moral sense to imagine somebody living 35 years in a country and never acquiring citizenship. On the other hand, rotational mobility, in which people come for 3-year, 5-year fixed periods and then return to their home countries enriched and with a massive savings and assets to use back in their home country, I think can thread the needle of saying, look, these people are eligible to work in our country, they want to work in our country, we can arrange terms and conditions on which we're willing to have them work in our country, but we're not integrating them socially and politically in a way that we expect them to remain forever. That is a tough sell, but it's in a world of impossible options. People are being unrealistic about how truly impossible the other alternatives are.
When you're talking about migrant workers in Gulf states, yep, for example, yep, there's a lot of criticism of those programs,
absolutely,
as well for not respecting the rights of those workers. Are you saying that that's a needle that can be threaded, we're just not doing it well enough?
Absolutely. I think those countries are criticized, and legitimately so at times. On the other hand, the gain they're giving to the workers they allow to move is under-acknowledged. There's been a recent calculation suggesting the gains to poverty from the Gulf states' openness to these workers far exceeds the total of what rich countries give in foreign aid. So yes, they're criticized for the rights, and yes, certainly any program for rotational migration has to focus on it. But I think given goodwill and the enforcement possibilities of rich countries, I think it's that difficult to create a rotational scheme that can not put migrant workers in positions in which they're abused and their rights aren't respected. Once one acknowledges political reality that that's what one is going to do. They had a program in New Zealand that created a deliberate development-friendly, rights-respecting seasonal migration for agriculture in New Zealand with respect to the Pacific Islands. They did a rigorous evaluation of it, and as you would expect, the wage gains were just massive. And they actually measured nearly everything else about the well-being, both of the people who moved, the locations they came from, the families, and they pretty much found it was win-win-win. The places they came from benefited from the repatriation of the wages they'd earned. The people who moved had higher incomes. New Zealand actually needed the labor because otherwise they were just going to have to give up those industries because they really weren't going to attract any citizens of New Zealand into those workers. But I'm the first to admit it's a difficult sell politically because people have to wrap their head around the conflation of who are future citizens and who can work here. It didn't exist for thousands and thousands of years of human history, and the period in which that's been widely accepted as true is actually very short, and I think it's about to be over.
Isn't there a problem for the countries from which those migrants are coming in that the most talented, the hardest working, the people who are most likely to help those countries develop themselves will be the ones most likely to leave?
Absolutely. Which is why my slogan is development friendly, rights respecting, rotational labor mobility. Development friendly precisely means I want the low skilled moving, not the high skilled. What's happening is they deliberately recruit the highest talented from those countries, whereas that's not, in fact, what UK or Europe or the US need. What they actually need is a bunch of labor-intensive, relatively low-skill occupations that aren't being filled now and which will continue to be a large part of the labor force. We did a calculation for the US, and we divided work into low-skill and what could be offshored. And it turns out, according to the US Department of Labor's own forecasts, the not-offshoreable low-skilled employment growth over the next 10 years was the entire growth of the native population. But we're talking about things like cleaning buildings, food service, gardening. Nobody in America has the aspiration that their kid end up in food service. So it's not that all the native citizens want to be in those jobs, but those jobs are there. There are jobs to be filled, but if you say, we're going to continue to link future citizenship with right to work, Then everybody wants to recruit NHS doctors from Ghana, and that obviously has ramifications for Ghana. But if Ghana could send gardeners and food service workers and low-skill workers, that's win-win. That's win for Ghana, because it makes their low-skill labor market tighter and likely raises wages in Ghana. So it's precisely avoiding the cream-skimming of the rich countries, which is why I want to develop ideas of rotational mobility that's development-friendly, because it's actually allowing the low-skilled a chance to move as well as the high-skilled.
We regularly hear from economists who are talking about the rise of the robots and that there will soon be mass unemployment in developed societies. This would seem like history's worst time to be welcoming hundreds of millions of migrant workers.
I think the whole enthusiasm of the rise of robots is maybe one of the most deeply evil phenomena in the world today. There's 1 billion people on the planet that would love to move to the rich countries, work their asses off at low-skilled jobs. Why we have the world's most talented people, high-tech engineers, entrepreneurs, developing robots to prevent those people from having the opportunity to work in our rich countries is just obscene. We have the world's scarcest resource, economizing and reducing the need for the world's most abundant resource, unskilled labor. That's just obscene.
Why isn't anyone else making this case right now, Len?
Because you sound like you're crazy. Your eyes have widened, as I've said several things in this interview. And I think what happens is it appears politically impossible, and so you seem a fool for saying it. But I sometimes teach my students this vision, and then I show them a picture of a historical U.S. figure, John Brown, who was an abolitionist who attempted to foment a slave rebellion and who was executed in the United States. Because he was a complete and total madman. Abolitionism movement was lunacy at the time. And I tell them the U.S. Civil War started in 1860, and to guess what year John Brown was executed. And they guess 20 years or 30 years before the start of the Civil War for these ideas to have come into transition. The answer is 1859. John Brown was crazy, and then he was crazy, and then he was crazy, and then he was a hero, because ideas changed very fast. So in a few years, I will be the mainstream.
Do we have time to put in place these programs of managed labor mobility? They tend to take a while when we talk about them politically.
Maybe, but I think they can come on very fast. Once people get used to the idea of it, I think they can expand very fast. And by the way, once they happen, people see the benefits of it. Migrants that are in rich countries are in rich countries because rich country citizens want them. Somebody wants to hire them. And so Italy often has flashes of anti-migrant sentiment, including some of the people in the current government. But when they actually went to take action against the migrants, turns out the migrants were in people households taking care of their elderly people. When the general rhetoric is, well, let's throw those foreigners out, that kind of resonates. But when they come and say, no, we mean the person taking care of your nana. Whoa, no. So I actually think once we start into this path, people will see the benefits of it and they'll become very popular and very ingrained. And once the demographic suicide kicks in and you really see what the consequences are, I think that'll be a second complete and total acceptance. In part because I think we can dovetail and make some of these programs occupation specific, where we start saying, this is just how many people we need for elder care. And I think when people see the win-win-win-win of elder care, they'll start to say, geez, why weren't we doing this before? And then we expand into other things like, why in the world are we inventing robots to pick crops when, again, there's 1 billion people on the planet perfectly happy to come in for the season, pick the crops, and go home? I think we can scale them very fast. I think it'll get very popular very fast. All on the premise that I know I'm crazy, but I think I'm crazy in a way that will be common sense in the future.
Lab Pritchett, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you want to read more about Lance's ideas or even want to check his maths, you can read his blog, which is called On Labour Mobility, Economic Growth and Targeted Programmes. That's on Vox EU. He's also got a blog called Europe's Refugee Crisis Hides a Bigger Problem on the Centre for Global Development website. And there's also an essay he wrote with Martina Villarengo called Why Demographic Suicide? The Puzzles of European Fertility. They're all easy to find online.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We're on all the major podcast platforms, or you can find the archives at voxeu.org/vox-talks.